You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
Relations between China and Canada were not good. As you may recall, two Canadians were essentially being held as diplomatic hostages. It's the kind of thing that can poison an international relationship. A year later, though, and so much has changed. The two Michaels are free and back in Canada, and, actually, that's about it. Canada has still not made a decision on Huawei. China's aggressive ascension towards becoming the dominant global superpower continues, as does their stance on Taiwan, their alleged human rights abuses, and all sorts of other things that can make the country seem unsavory, let's say, to the Democratic Western Alliance. And now there is a deadline on the horizon. So no Canadian diplomats will attend the games in Beijing. That's how it starts, but how will it end? Will our athletes join the boycott? Will athletes from other nations join theirs? Should we be worried about sending some of our brightest young stars to a nation that has proven itself capable of, essentially, kidnapping them? As 2022 begins, what to do about China is still Canada's biggest foreign policy question. The answers now are perhaps even more important than they were a year ago, and we still don't have any good ones. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Stephanie Carvin is a former national security analyst, an associate professor of international affairs at Carleton University, and the author of Stand on Guard, Reassessing Threats to Canada's National Security, which I guess it's pretty clear at this point includes China, Stephanie.
Yeah, pretty much. There's quite a few chapters, actually. So yes, that's correct.
We're going to talk about, well, maybe not all those chapters, but we're going to talk a lot about what the next year or so could look like in terms of Canada-China relations, but also just about a resurgent and ascendant China on the geopolitical scene. And maybe we can start with this, because the last time we talked to you was right around when the two Michaels were released. What did that do to our relations with China? Did they improve?
I don't think so. I mean, put it this way, they didn't get worse, right? So, I mean, if there was bad relations between the two countries, you know, hopefully in some ways that was the nadir. But I think what it did was it removed what was certainly the largest thorn in the relationship between the two countries, right? These two individuals. Although, you know, every time I mention the two Michaels, I also like to mention there's probably 100 Canadians that are being held right now in Chinese prison, including a Uyghur activist, Hussein Salil, who's not supposed to get out of jail now until 2036 and has no consular access. So in some ways that issue has resolved, at least I think in the mind of the public, but in reality, that issue does still continue to exist today.
How come we're not talking about those people and we were talking about the two Michaels? How come I just found out about this now as you casually drop it into a conversation?
Right. I mean, it just doesn't seem to get the same kind of publicity. There's a couple of reasons. One is that some of these individuals have actually committed crimes, right? They've committed offenses, drug smuggling, things like that. So they are serving jail sentences for actual crimes. But in other cases, it's also, you know, to be blunt, I mean, these are, you know, Chinese Canadians. They are sometimes not seen as Canadians for that reason, right? They're not right. And so I think this is, certain journalists like Joanna Chu at the Toronto Star has made this point that, you know, there's dozens of Canadians being held, but because they're Chinese, we don't really see it as a Canadian problem.
That's really interesting, because I did not know that. I'm pretty sure a lot of our listeners didn't. And we're speaking to you about a week after Canada joined a diplomatic, not athletic, boycott of the upcoming Winter Games. What word would you use to describe, I guess, the relationship between Canada and China right now? As, you know, it might not have worsened over the release of the Michaels, but we are still clearly ready to join our traditional allies in a boycott.
So the way I would describe the relationship is it's frozen, right? And not in the let it go kind of way. I mean, it's really seems to be stuck. As I said earlier, maybe in some ways the actual bleeding has stopped, but the wound is still there. And I don't think there's a lot of prospect for it getting better anytime soon. I think in a large way, the issue of the two Michaels, and, you know, if not the rest of the individuals in China, kind of, I think, opened the eyes of people in Canada as to the nature of the regime and the way that it is able to retaliate when it feels its interests have been aggrieved in some way. So I think going forward, I don't really see a lot of opportunity for warm relationships kind of restarting. I mean, if you think back to 2015, the Liberal government literally campaigned on an idea of having free trade with China. And, you know, here we are in 2021, and something we've seen throughout the course of the year is more and more restrictions being placed on Canada's interactions with China, whether it's in research at universities, whether it is in you know, trade in certain goods, whether it's in foreign investment, and now this Olympic decision as well. You know, it's not to do with trade and investment, but this diplomatic boycott has come through. So, yeah, I do think that this relationship is frozen. We've seen this sliding throughout the year, but, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how the government decides to move next, because it's not at all clear what the path is going to be. Except that I don't think it's going to be a warm embrace of China anytime soon.
We'll talk about what we could see on those issues in 2022 in just a second. But just to explore the diplomatic boycott a little bit more, in terms of all of those issues you just described, on how many of them is the traditional Western alliance, the Five Eyes? I know we've seen the US do it and Australia do it. How many of them are they aligned on? Is this sort of the way everybody in this alliance sees China? Is there any split between countries and their diplomatic intentions?
Well, I think the big difference in 2021 versus 2020 is Joe Biden, right? The president of the United States, who, you know, although President Trump took a harsh stance against China, put it that way, Joe Biden actually seems to be much better at kind of rallying international support and trying to bring democratic countries together. We saw last week, of course, there was the Summit of the Democracies, which China wasn't invited and was very upset. But I think, you know, Joe Biden is going to show leadership in being able to bring countries together. So in terms of being united, I actually see that growing. It is interesting to me that the decision to engage the boycott wasn't kind of a joint announcement. It seemed like the United States kind of just decided, although apparently there had been talks with the Trudeau government before, that was followed then by Australia, Lithuania, and the United Kingdom, and now Canada. So, you know, there's clearly a similar view on these kinds of things. We're also seeing it in terms of thinking about cooperation on the development of technology, on restrictions on certain kinds of Chinese technology, particularly in the telecommunications sector, but also in sectors like artificial intelligence and machine learning. And then as well, you know, I think that there's this idea that something has to be done with regards to the Asia-Pacific, or what's now increasingly being called the Indo-Pacific region, in terms of kind of China's perceived aggressiveness in that area.
Last question on the Olympics, just because it's been in the news lately, and it'll be the first time these relations are tested in 2022, probably. Does China really give a crap about a diplomatic boycott as long as these countries send their athletes and they can host the games and have a big pomp and circumstance? Like, why would they care if there's no diplomats?
Yeah, I mean, I saw some people joking that, you know, the biggest sufferers from this will be the canapes that will go uneaten by the diplomats that should have been attending. But I'm actually less cynical than that. I think China does value symbolism. I think it values that symbolism very highly. And so when you take this kind of symbolic action, yes, it does mean something. Now, is it fatally damaging to the Olympics? Absolutely not. Does it mean that China won't be able to get its narrative across of it being kind of an ascendant power and trying to encourage other countries to see all of its achievements? No, it's not going to do that at all. But was this kind of a symbolic gesture that is nevertheless irksome and does send a message? Yeah, I think it does. So if you think back a few years ago, the Chinese government was tremendously upset at the Gap clothing chain, because they had produced a t-shirt that didn't include Taiwan as a part of China. And they basically threatened the entire Gap clothing chain in China because of this one t-shirt.
Right.
They were threatening to prohibit airlines from landing in China if they didn't put Taiwan as part of the People's Republic of China. I mean, this is very symbolic stuff. But they take it very seriously. So I don't actually think we should underestimate the impact of a diplomatic boycott. And I do actually expect some kind of retaliation.
When you say some kind of retaliation, and I think of recent history and the way Chinese-Canadian relations have gone, I question why we're sending dozens, if not hundreds, of our finest young athletes over there.
I think Canadians should be concerned. I think the Canadian Olympic Committee should be concerned. I don't expect our athletes to be targeted. I don't expect them to be arrested. And I mean, if there's some, I don't know, maybe some good news. I don't know if it's really good news, but if there is some good news here, it's not the first time we have sent athletes to an authoritarian country, or at least a country with a less than stellar human rights record. So, you know, we do have some practice here. But I mean, China has perfected its surveillance state unlike any other country on earth. If you travel to China, there's going to be software installed on your phone, unbeknownst to you, that is going to be tracking your communications, tracking your whereabouts, and kind of following you around. Mm. You know, they have facial recognition software. Right. They have a very good Ministry of State Security that's going to make sure that that can follow you around and tail you. So there is some risk here to the people who are going there in the sense that they could be tracked. They could, you know, who they speak with is going to be monitored. Certainly, they're always going to be targeted for strategies and anything that might give the, you know, the home team some kind of edge. But in this particular case, you know, having done a diplomatic slight, the idea that Canadian athletes might actually experience kind of further harassment is definitely not beyond the pale. And, you know, speaking to security authorities here in Ottawa, they're not ruling out anything. Hmm. They're not really, you know, it's unlikely that athletes would be arrested. But, you know, given what's happened over the past, you know, 2-3 years with regards to the two Michaels, it's entirely possible that it could happen again.
What does China want from Canada at this point?
That's a really interesting question. I think in the short term, it does want trade in some ways to resume as normal. It wants Canada to drop some of the trade restrictions that have been put on it, particularly in the areas of telecommunications. I mean, Huawei gets all the attention, but Canada recently stopped the investment of China Mobile, another telecommunications company, into Canada as well. They're now suing the federal government. They also want, you know, more deals. They want to be able to invest in our natural resources. They want to build telecommunications in the Arctic. Joint ventures between Chinese companies and Canadian companies, where, you know, the basis of the agreement is that the Canadian company shares its intellectual property for some kind of stake in the Chinese market. And that's a way for Chinese companies to get access to some very valuable research, customers, products. But in some ways, the Canadian company suffers because it's kind of handing over its most valuable assets in order to actually access the Chinese economy. So I think this is the kind of short-term thing that China really wants from Canada. It also really doesn't want Canada joining into a Western kind of alliance. I think that China is rightfully sensing that other countries in the world are kind of looking at China and they're concerned. And we saw earlier this year that there's now going to be a security alliance between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States called very, very awkwardly AUKUS. It's a nuclear sub-agreement. But it suggests that, you know, states are kind of beefing up their security posture in the region. And certainly China wouldn't want Canada to be a part of that as well. So I think that's probably both the short and long positioning of Canada in any kind of alliance is going to be kind of a long-term goal. You know, we talk a lot about Canada not knowing how to engage in China. I also wonder, to a certain extent, if Chinese officials are now wondering how they are going to move on its relations with Canada, having just kind of thrown everything out the window after the detention of the two Michaels.
From a national security perspective, I mean, put your analyst hat on here. There's a growing Western alliance lining up against China that, as you mentioned, we're not quite officially a part of yet, but obviously history would suggest that's kind of where we line up. And China really, really wants to be seen as this ascendant nation, the global superpower, etc. Do we have, I guess, bargaining power in this situation? You know, they don't probably want the optics of all their traditional Western countries lining up against them. Is there a chance here for Canada to extract some concessions from China?
You know, historically, Canada has not really participated in a military alliance in the Pacific since the Korean War. We certainly send ships there, and certainly recently we've been making a point of sending ships through the Taiwan Straits and things like this. But, you know, we don't really have a vast military or diplomatic presence in the region at all. So I think as a result of this, what we are seeing is that our allies, the United States and Europe, have both been putting forward visions of how they see their engagement in the region as a whole. And Canada doesn't actually have a strategy. We don't have a foreign policy, let alone an Asia-Pacific or Indo-Pacific strategy.
Right. We've talked about that.
So what's happening now is that there is a big review that's happening. It's interesting. They actually went outside the government and hired former diplomats to conduct this review on how Canada should engage in this region. And this brings us back to that question you just asked. Well, what should we do? Do we have any leverage here? And this is something we have to evaluate. Again, we don't have a lot of assets in the region. We're not really considered a major player, despite having a very large Pacific coast. And then in addition, there's, I think, a kind of debate among people who look at China in Canada. There's people who say, you know, Canada is actually really caught between China and the United States, that, yeah, you know, we have an opportunity here to kind of balance maybe some of the issues we have with the United States with improved relations with China. We can diversify our trade, and these would all be very good things. And you know, now that the United States is potentially looking at potentially even a second Trump administration, or, you know, some democratic backsliding, maybe we do need to kind of hedge our bets a bit. On the other hand, however, you have people who are saying, no, I mean, Canada is still very much in the Western alliance. The vast majority of our trade goes to Western countries, that we share values with the United States, even in its kind of imperfect state and a long undefended border. It's just not comparative.
Right.
So, I mean, I think this is the thing that the new strategy, which we are expecting in 2022, will have to reconcile, right? Do we play this role as maybe kind of a third party between the West and China? Or do we actually kind of firmly situate ourselves within this Western alliance in order to maybe counter some of the things that we don't like seeing coming out of that part of the world and certain kinds of Chinese assertiveness and attempts to really kind of put pressure on different countries?
I don't often use this expression, but this is more of a comment than a question. It seems insane to me to think that a country with little to no foreign policy at all could successfully walk the tightrope between the United States of America and China as both of them become more authoritarian. Like, that, why would we put ourselves in that position? It seems like really just a tempting fate, I guess.
I'm not sure I agree with that point of view, but I think the idea is, you know, like, who are we? Are we an independent country, or are we a member,
right,
of the full Western alliance, right? And yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be very hard for us to be a fully independent country outside. I mean, given our the very nature of our security apparatus, we have, you know, forget NATO, we also have NORAD, we have other, you know, we basically can't deploy our forces without the United States.
We have like 6 helicopters or something, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're not flying that well right now, from what I understand from media reports. But yeah, I mean, it's hard for Canada to deploy without the United States. This idea that we can be this kind of fully neutral party between the two countries is unrealistic. But I think what people who make this point are trying to say is that, you know, is it a good idea to put all of our eggs in the U.S. basket right now? And I think that is a bit of a risk. But at the same time, you have to ask yourself, is the Chinese basket looking any more stable?
That's fair. And I guess what I'm trying to get a sense of, and why we invited you on this show to bring it to the end of this conversation, is, how will we know that? What will you be watching for in the early months of 2022, I guess, including the Olympics, but also everything else, to get a sense of what's going to happen next year in terms of the relationship between these two countries, but also in terms of China's plans globally, I guess.
Well, there's a couple of things I'm going to be looking for. The first one is the strategy that I mentioned, right? The Canadian government is going to be coming out with an Indo-Pacific strategy that looks at Canada's engagement in that region and finally sets out a vision of what it wants to achieve and how it intends to achieve it. Now, we'll see how good that is, if it's just kind of lofty rhetoric or if it actually puts, you know, is there meat on the bones of this policy? That'll be something that I look for, because I think that's going to determine the direction, at least, of the Trudeau government for the next coming years. The second thing I'm going to be looking for is Huawei. We have this Huawei, you know, instead of waiting for Godot, we have waiting for Huawei. It is this long-awaited decision about what we should do about this telecommunications company. And, you know, the government's position is not that it's making a decision about Huawei. It's making a decision about the future of 5G generally in Canada. And I think this is part of the reason it's taking its time, is that it's actually trying to look at the landscape and figuring out, okay, well, what kind of technologies do we need and who do we want to source those technologies from? And then do we actually have the power as a government to get rid, you know, to actually get rid of Huawei if we don't want it in our systems? I mean, this may actually require new legislation. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is actually the Olympics themselves. It's going to be interesting to see how Canadian athletes are treated. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, do Canadians watch? There is a movement to actually boycott. I mean, Canadians themselves don't have to watch if they don't want to, if they are upset at what's going on, either with the Uyghurs or, you know, just human rights situation generally. You can make the decision not to watch, and that hurts the advertising, right? If you don't want to see this happen.
I will tell you, though, as somebody who spent a long time in sports media in terms of many of these issues and threatened boycotts, when the games start, people tune in. Like, I'm just not optimistic that'll ever happen.
Oh, no, and I think that's fair. I mean, I think it's going to be hard for Canada to resist watching a gold medal hockey game. I mean, I think that's just like, you know, I think
unless the athletes decide not to go. That's kind of the wild card.
That's going to be interesting to see if any athletes themselves make that decision. I think it would be a very heartbreaking decision to make, and I don't envy any of them. But I could understand if they didn't want to go, either for human rights concerns or even their own personal safety. I think that's a reasonable concern. But I think the final thing that I'm going to be looking for is just a little bit more general, right? Putting together a foreign policy, as you said, kind of earlier, like, can we as our middle power with our six helicopters actually manage to come up with some kind of strategy in this region? And that's just it, right? Dealing with China requires us to do big things and to think big thoughts and to have grand plans. And the Trudeau government has had a lot of very soaring rhetoric, but we've only really seen this rhetoric applied to a few areas like climate change, and to be fair, like trying to deal with the pandemic. But none of this rhetoric about foreign policy has ever really come true at all. So it's going to be really interesting to see. We saw in the speech from the throne earlier this year that the Trudeau government said it was going to take on authoritarian states. That was the first thing it said about in the small section on foreign policy. It made a statement about dealing with authoritarian countries, of which, no question, China is one of them. So what does it actually do in order to, you know, strengthen democracy worldwide, to give the government itself the tools that it needs to actually, you know, have a foreign policy and then carry it out effectively? I think this is going to be very important, and something that many of us who watch international affairs will be looking forward to, hopefully, in 2022.
Stephanie, thank you for this. And waiting to see if this government will back up its words with action is the final word on many topics these days.
Indeed.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Stephanie Carvin's book is called Stand on Guard, Reassessing Threats to Canada's National Security. You can find it at your favorite local bookstore. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Talk to us anytime via email, TheBigStoryPodcast, that's all one word, at rci.rogers.com. This podcast is available in every single podcast player. And, of course, on your favorite smart speaker, just ask it to play The Big Story Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.